Good afternoon, and once again, welcome. This lesson is being recorded for Sunday, December the 21st, 2025. This is the lesson that will be presented when we gather together at 6 o'clock here in Bellflower at the Rose Avenue Church of Christ. And as is always the case, if you are in our area, we invite you to come and be with us as we gather together throughout the week to worship God and to study His Word. Each Sunday, we have a Bible study at 9:45. Our morning worship is at 10:50. A second worship service is at 6 o'clock Sunday evening. And then on Wednesday night at 7:30, we have a Bible study. And you're welcome to join us each time we do gather together. You'll be our honored guest. And it is our hope that as you are with us, you will see that in everything we do, we try to respect the pattern that God has given us within His Word. Just by way of reminder, next Sunday is the fourth Sunday night of the month, and because of that, there will be no Sunday evening recorded. So let's go ahead and get started with the lesson that we have prepared for today. Today I am going to be dealing with our continued study of our journey through the Bible. Typically, we address this the second Sunday of the month, but last week I was out of town, and so I am presenting this lesson here today. And of course, we are continuing to deal with this journey through the Bible, which is the study of the 17 time periods of Bible history. Up to this point, we've actually noted 8 of the 17 time periods over the course of the last about 40 years as we have done this. You have the period prior to the flood, and then you have the flood and the events that are associated with that. You have the scattering of the nations in Genesis chapter 11. And then you have the period of the patriarchs, which takes you through the end of the book of Genesis. Following that, you have Israel while they are in Egypt, as well as the Exodus that takes place. And then you have the wilderness wanderings, which lasts for 40 years, followed by the conquest of the land and the dividing of the nation as recorded in the book of Joshua. And then finally, and we just concluded our study of the period of the judges, where Israel was judged by, or Israel was led by leaders, deliverers who delivered them from various types of oppressions. And that brings us today to the beginning of the ninth of the 17 time periods of history, which is described as the United Kingdom. This will be followed by what is described as the Divided Kingdom. That will be followed by a period of time when Judah is alone because Israel has been carried away into captivity. And then you have Israel in the Babylonian captivity and the return from that particular captivity and events that are associated with that. That will be followed by the period of silence, the period between the Testaments. And then you have, after that, you have the Gospels, which is the life of Jesus. And then, of course, you have the beginning of the church, followed by letters that are written to the various churches. And that's the 17 time periods. And today we begin the ninth, which is the United Kingdom. And the reason it's called the United Kingdom is because all of Israel is united for the most of this time under a single king. And this is the only period where the 12 tribes are united under a single king, as we will see as we study through this this particular time period. Now, this is a time period that actually, and the reason it's described as a kingdom is because this is a period where Israel is going to be actually governed by a king, as opposed to he was governed by the priesthood and by good prior. They were governed by the priesthood as well as God prior to this taking place. And interestingly, Israel is actually not described as a kingdom prior to this. You know, they're described as a nation. They're a great nation. They're described as a land and so on. But when it comes to the term kingdom, it was not associated with the way that they were ruled. As a matter of fact, there's a couple of passages that you might consider when you think about that. For example, over in Exodus chapter 19 and in verse number 6, This is the only time where you have this description of being a kingdom, and it says here, you shall be to me, that is Yahweh speaking, you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel. You're going to be a kingdom of priests, and this is obviously a reference to God. As a matter of fact, in 1 Samuel 8 and verse 7, which we'll touch in a little while here, they rejected God from ruling over them. And actually in chapter 12 and verse 12, toward the conclusion of today's lesson, you will find that God made the point there, or Samuel makes the point, that you have rejected God as your king. You also have Deuteronomy chapter 17, which talks about looking forward to a time when they would have a king and instructions concerning his kingdom. And I'm going to touch on that here just a moment or two as we get to that particular point. But as we're looking at this period of the United Kingdom, it is a period that lasts for approximately 120 years, and there are three different kings who rule during this time period. From a historical standpoint, as far as a timeline, it is estimated to be somewhere between around 1050 to 930 BC. And bear in mind, when you're dealing with the time before Christ came to this earth, or before the Common Era, as some people want to say today, that the timing goes backwards from the standpoint of beginning to end. So you have about 120 years there. Biblically, according to sources, this particular time period consists of about 97 chapters of Bible history. It will begin in 1 Samuel chapter 8, which we actually talked about a couple of months ago with Samuel, and it proceeds through 2 Kings chapter 11, where the kingdom actually divides. You also have the book of 1 Chronicles, which after the first 9 chapters, which deals with the genealogies of the various tribes, as well as various families associated with the Levites and Judah and other things like that. Then beginning in about 1 Chronicles chapter 9 or 10 and through 2 Chronicles chapter 9, you're dealing with this period of history that is known as the United Kingdom. And a word of observation as you're dealing with this is, when we talk about the kings in the Chronicles, we have here parallel accounts, if you will, in the same way that there are 4 Gospels about Jesus, and there's parallel accounts that are recorded there, and you get details. The same thing is true with the Kings and the Chronicles, as well as Second Samuel. And what you're actually going to find is in First Samuel, you're dealing with the first king of the United Kingdom, which is Saul. And then 2 Samuel, you're reading about the reign of David. And in 2 Samuel, that's actually where we pick up with 2 Chronicles chapters 9 and 10, or 1 Chronicles chapters 9 and 10. And 1 Chronicles deals with the reign of David, along with 2 Samuel. And then you have the first few chapters of 2 Kings are dealing with Saul as the king, King Solomon is what you have in that particular text there, along with the first 9 chapters of 2 Chronicles. That's where you read about the kingdom of Solomon from that standpoint. So we have we will be introduced to kings and so on. And of course, the difference between Chronicles and the Kings, Chronicles actually records the history of Judah, while 1 and 2 Kings records the history of Israel and Judah when you get into the divided kingdom. That's what you're going to be dealing with there from that standpoint. So let's go ahead and get started here with what we are dealing with in this particular text here. considering this, continuing to deal with this land here, there's three kings, as I've mentioned, and the three kings are Saul, David, and Solomon, and each of them reigns for about 40 years. Acts 13:21 tells us that Saul reigned for 40 years, and we also read about David and Solomon reigning for 40 years each. And it's interesting because these three kings are just different as far as their relationship with God. King Saul, he was bad. And he starts out good, but that deteriorates very, very quickly. And of course, then you have David, who's described as a man after God's own heart. He's a very righteous king, and he was human. But he was a righteous king. And then, of course, you have Solomon, who was mostly good, or I would describe as good for most of his reign, but toward the end, he turns away from God. So there you have the three kings. And, of course, as we go through their lives, we're also going to be introduced to a number of different, what you would describe as supporting characters. That is, leaders, priests, prophets, military leaders, generals, and so on, who are associated with the various kings. You're going to read about wives. You're going to read about enemies that they engaged in, and other individuals. So there's going to be a number of different individuals that we will be introduced during these particular individuals here. Now, as to the period itself, it's also a period that was rich in literature. In addition to the 97 chapters of Bible history, it is more than half the Psalms, or about half of the Psalms, were actually written by David during this time period. You also have Solomon, who is credited with the books of Proverbs, the book of Ecclesiastes, as well as Song of Solomon. And at least one of the Psalms was written by Solomon, Psalm 72, and possibly others that he wrote as well that are recorded. And there are some who also actually believe that Job was written sometime during this period, though we don't know that to be the case. We don't know when Job was written. It could be inserted into a number of places. Some have said Moses wrote it. And so you have different speculations about that. But in the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew religious text known as our Old Testament, and the Jews called it the Tanakh, which was describing the three different divisions of the Hebrew Bible, the Torah being the first five books, the Nevi'im being the historical books, and then the Ketuvim being the books of literature that are associated with that. And you'll find that all of the books that we describe as the books of poetry that are listed on this slide, they're all a part of that last section of the Hebrew Bible or the Hebrew religious text. So this is a period where that actually takes place. And furthermore, in dealing with this period, it was known mostly as a period of peace. Now, King Saul dealt with a lot more conflict, but David deals with it some and so on. But for the most part, during the reigns of David and Solomon in particular, Israel enjoyed peace, and also they enjoyed their greatest prosperity as the nation of God's people. As a matter of fact, it's interesting to note that during the period of Solomon in particular, David and Solomon, they expanded the territory of the kingdom of Israel. And it's interesting, over in Genesis 15 and verse 18, this is where God is speaking to Abraham about this covenant that they make. And he says to them in verse 18, "On the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, 'To your descendants I have given the land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates.'" And so, and if you are to look on a map, you will find the river of Egypt. It's not the Nile River, but it's basically the border. The border of Egypt, and then you have the other river, which is the Euphrates River, which is actually north, quite a bit north of the nation of Canaan, or the nation of Israel, that was established during the time of Joshua and as recorded in that book. But then you go over to 1 Kings chapter 4 and in verse number 21, and you read there concerning Solomon as he is reigning. It says, Solomon reigned over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt, though they brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. So basically you find the kingdom is expanded, or at least under tribute to Israel, from the Euphrates to the river of Egypt. So you find the fulfillment of God's promises and the territory expanding as God is with his people during this united kingdom period. And so that's what you have during this particular time period. Also, it is during this time period that Yahweh expands details that are related to the coming Messiah. In particular, when we get to David in 2 Samuel chapter 7, and also recorded in 1 Chronicles 17, you find the promises from Yahweh to establish the throne of David forever. And of course, this is going to establish the dynasty of Judah from the time of David, which is going to actually last about 420 years up until Judah is carried away into Babylonian captivity around 586 BC. So this is a significant period of time from the standpoint of God further unfolding his messianic promise that he made to Abraham. Now, that brings us to the kingdom of Israel. And remember, this is where Israel demands a king. And a couple of months ago when we dealt with this, we read through this particular text here, describing it as the ending of the period of the judges. And you may recall that Samuel's sons, Joel and Abijah, they were wicked. And some of they engaged in immoral behavior and bribes and things like that, so that the people despised coming to serve God. And so they come to Samuel and say, look, you're righteous, but your sons aren't. We want a king so that we can be not like the nations around us. And of course, you may recall that Samuel was upset because of this. And he goes to the Lord. And what we read in verse 7 of 1 Samuel 8 is, the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. And of course he tells them, heed their voice, but I want you to warn them about what the behavior of a king is going to be like. So here we are. We are going to begin, and Samuel is going to appoint Saul as their first king. But before I actually get to the text there in 1 Samuel, there's a couple of passages I want us to read here real quickly. One of them is in 1 Samuel 8, but I want us to turn back to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 17. And what you find in this particular text here is Moses knows that Israel is about to live in the promised land, go into the promised land, and they're going to be governed by the priests, and God is supposed to be their king, and there to be a kingdom of priests and so on, as the description is there. But I want you to notice in Deuteronomy 17, and beginning in verse 14, instructions that are given when you have a king. And you'll notice it says, this is Deuteronomy 17:14, when you come to the land which the Lord your God has given you, and possess it and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. And isn't that what's happening here? He says, you're going to come into the land and you're going to demand a king. And when you do, verse 15, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Nor shall he greatly multiply silver or gold for himself. Also it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book for the one before from the one before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. So here you find Moses is giving instructions. When you finally demand a king, and the point he's making there is, that's not what God has intended, but when you do, you know, understand this is what you do. Number one, he is to be chosen by God. Let God choose who the king is going to be, number one, and he's not to be a foreigner. And incidentally, you'll note on this chart, I have Genesis 49, 8 through 10. This is when Jacob is blessing the 12 sons, and he's talking about Judah there, and he's talking about how the scepter's not going to depart from Judah. And that's a prophecy that's leading to David, is what that's leading to. And of course, it becomes messianic because of that. But he goes on and he says there, you shall not multiply horses or the idea of that is you trust in the Lord to take care of you rather than trusting in military armor. You shall not return to Egypt for horses, which means you're not going to turn to foreign nations to deliver you. You're going to trust Yahweh in those things. You're not to multiply yourself for yourself wives, lest they turn you away from God. And of course, we remember Solomon, but we're going to see other examples of that in both the United and Divided Kingdom. You shall not multiply for yourself silver and gold. And the idea of that is where you trust in your material prosperity and you forget about God because of that. And furthermore, and what was so interesting as we read there, kings were to take the law before the priests, and they were to personally write a copy of the law for themselves. Write it down and keep it with them and read it all the days of their reign and do what it says, and in so doing God would bless them, and that's the promise. So that's the instructions that were given when they had a king. Now let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 8. And remember, the people have rejected God and they've demanded a king. And God said to Samuel, you give them a king, but you tell them what a king is going to do to them. And you read beginning there in verse number 11 of chapter 8. And he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen. And some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties, will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers, and he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, your olive groves, and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants, and he will take your male and female servants and your female servants, your finest young men and your donkeys, and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. So he makes the point there. You want a king? This is what he's going to do. You know, he's going to take your sons. He's going to send them out to war. Many of them are not going to come home. They're going to die. because they're fighting the battles. He's going to take them to be His servants. If He needs men to do something, what He wants, He's going to take your sons. He's going to take your daughters to be His cooks and to be His perfumers and to provide whatever it is that He wants. Take them for His pleasure. He's going to take the best of your lands if He wants. He's going to give those to His friends. He's going to give them to His servants. And He's going to tax you. And He's going to keep on taxing you. He's going to take a tenth of everything that you have. And so He goes from there. And then, of course, in verse 18, when you regret it and you cry out to God because of the king that you've chosen, He said, I'm not going to hear you. You've chosen a king. He's your ruler. You got what you asked for and the consequences that are associated with. So there you have the warnings that are dealing with this kingdom and what is going to take place where that is concerned. So that becomes the background. And of course, we know that they said, we want a king anyways. And God said, give them their king. And so Samuel sends them home and says, you're going to get a king. And that brings us to our text that we want to touch on for a few moments here in this particular lesson. And that is, we want to look at chapters 9 through 12 of 1 Samuel. And this, of course, is where Saul is chosen to be their first king. And of course, we're introduced to Saul in chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. And we read in that particular text there that Saul was the son of a man whose name was Kish. And he was of the tribe of Benjamin. Then you find there in verses 9 through 26 that some of the donkeys of Kish actually wander away somewhere. They're lost. And Kish sends Saul out to find these particular donkeys. And it is in this text where we are going to be introduced to Samuel as he is related with Saul. So Saul is introduced to Samuel in this particular occasion here. And so what you find taking place is Saul takes one of his servants and they go looking for the donkeys of Kish. And they go from place to place and they can't find them. Then the servant suggests to Saul, you know, there's a man of God in this location that what he says happens. In other words, he's a prophet. And he says, let's go find him. And interestingly, and I just want you to note this verse in chapter 9 of 1 Samuel. Verse 9, it says, formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he spoke thus, come, let us go to the seer. For he who is now called a prophet was formerly called a seer. So we've talked about seers, and the idea is that somebody that sees something, but now they're called prophets. So here, Samuel is described as a prophet, and of course they go, and of course the servant provides some resources to pay for information to find out about his donkeys. Meanwhile, Yahweh has appeared to Samuel and told him that Saul was going to come to him. And when he came, Samuel was to anoint him as the king that Israel was asking for. And that's exactly what takes place in the latter part of chapter 9. We find that when Samuel meets him, Samuel actually tells Saul, your donkeys have been found. Don't worry about that. But then Samuel says some things to Saul about how blessed he is and so on, and basically how he's going to be a ruler of the people. And to that, Saul responds, why would you pick me? In verse 21 of chapter 9, am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak to me like this? And of course, Saul takes Samuel on this occasion, and he has a feast. And basically, Saul is placed in the position of honor at this particular feast. So something's going on. Saul doesn't fully understand what's happening at this time. And that leads us basically to chapter 10. It's actually the last verse of chapter 9 and into chapter 10, where we find that Samuel sends the servant of Saul ahead, and he wants to talk to Saul for a moment. And when he does, he anoints Saul with oil. He officially anoints him to become king. And this is when, in God's eyes, Saul actually becomes the king. And following this, he gives Saul some interesting instructions. And he basically says there, as you go home, certain things are going to happen. You're going to run across a couple of people in this place. At another place, you're going to run across three men who are carrying various items. One of them's carrying three loaves of bread, and he's going to give you two of the loaves of bread. And then the third group of people that you're going to run into is a group of prophets who are singing and praising God, and the Spirit is going to come on you, and you're going to prophesy with those individuals. So with very specific detail, Samuel tells Saul exactly what is happening. And of course, the reason he's doing this is so that Saul will know that this is from God. And that's actually what is taking place in this. And as he returns home, the things that Samuel prophesied happened exactly the way that Samuel said they were going to happen. And you have such detail that this had to be the hand of God. And so God's proving that this is what he wanted to happen. And of course, it's interesting that after all these things happen, and recall that Saul meets this group of prophets, and the Spirit of the Lord, or the Spirit of God, comes on him, and he actually begins to prophesy. And then he returns home, or returns toward his home. And it's interesting because his uncle in chapter 10 and verse 10 wants to know where Saul has actually been. Where did you go? He says in verse 14. And Saul said, I went to look for my donkeys, or I went to look for the donkeys, and so on. And he said, well, we couldn't find them. We went to Samuel the prophet. And his uncle asked him, what'd Samuel say? He said the donkeys have been found. But it's interesting because he says he did not tell his uncle about being anointed as king. Which is kind of interesting. What would you say if you were in that particular circumstance? But he's not telling anybody at this particular time. And then that brings us to the second half of chapter 10, which is where Saul is publicly proclaimed to be king by Samuel. So Samuel actually introduces Saul as the king that they were looking for. At Mizpah, all the people are gathered together, and lots are cast, which is kind of interesting. And the tribe of Benjamin is chosen of all the tribes, and then the family that will lead to the family of Saul is chosen. And again, this is just demonstrating that this is the hand of God at work, that this is the will of God. God is choosing the king at this time. But it's interesting, when Saul is chosen and they know he's the one that's chosen, they can't find him. It says he's actually hiding in the equipment, as the New King James reads this particular text. And it's interesting because Yahweh, the Lord, tells them that's where he is, he's hiding. And they go and they find Saul hiding, and they drag him out of his hiding place. And he says he's taller than anybody else. So he stands, you know, head, you might use the expression head and shoulder over everybody else. And this is your king. And the people are grateful and they shout, long live the king. And then he returns to his home. And notice, he doesn't return to a palace because, you know, this is their first king. A palace has not yet been built. The king's properties have not been developed yet at this time. And then you also read in the last verse of chapter 10 that there were some wicked men, rebellious men, who basically were not willing to follow after Saul. I mean, and it probably had something to do with Saul hiding. They're thinking that he's weak. Why are we going to follow him? So they don't pay tribute like they're supposed to. And it says that Saul held his peace. You know, he's humble. He's humble and meek at this time, maybe even unsure at this particular time. But that's not going to last. Nevertheless, in chapter 11, we find, we read about Jabesh-Gilead. And you may remember, in our last lesson on this study, we noted in Judges chapter 21 where Benjamin was almost totally wiped out because of their immorality, because of their ungodly behavior and so on, and some of the things that they did. And because they were almost wiped out, we find that men of Jabesh-Gilead, which was a city that did not participate in the battle, about 400 wives were found from that city to provide wives for the Benjamites that remained so that the tribe could be preserved. Well, here we come a little bit later, and we find that the Amorites actually come up against the city. The city of Jabesh-Gilead, and the king basically wants to subdue the city. And they say, "What are your conditions of peace?" And the king of the Amorites said, "You know what? We will make peace with you if all your men come out and we poke out your right eyes." That's a pretty harsh thing that they're demanding there. But they're basically saying, "Well, we're going to be in control. We're going to be in control of you." And of course, they say, "You know what, give us a few days to make a decision whether we will submit to you." And the men of Jabesh-Gilead send a message throughout the tribes looking for a deliverer. And then in verse number 6, word comes to Saul about this. And it says in verse 6 of chapter 11 that the Spirit of the Lord came upon Saul at this particular time. And he musters together the nation. As a matter of fact, he rallies about 330,000 troops and divides them into three groups, and they basically come up against the Amorites, and they defeat the Amorites, and the men of Jabesh-Gilead are delivered from their enemies, subdued from their enemies at this time. And of course, this helps establish the prominence of Saul. Now the people are ready to follow after Saul. He has proven himself to be their leader. And that brings us to chapter 12, which is where Saul is coronated. Now, he's already been anointed king, so he's already their king. But now, on this occasion, finally, they officially recognize him as king. And of course, Samuel, he addresses the people on this occasion. And it's kind of interesting, in the first few verses of this chapter, we read here in verse 1, of chapter 12, Samuel said to all Israel, "Indeed, I have heeded your voice in all that you said to me, and have made a king over you. And now here is the king walking before you, and I am old and gray-headed, and look, my sons are with you. I have walked before you from my childhood to this day. Here I am. Witness against me before the Lord and before his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Or whose donkey have I taken, and in whom have I, or of whom have I cheated? Whom have I oppressed, or from whose hand have I received any bribe with which to blind my eyes? I will restore it to you." And they said, "You have not cheated us or oppressed us, nor have you taken anything from your man's hand." Then he said to them, "The Lord is witness against you, and his anointed in this is witness this day that you have not found anything in my hand." And they addressed, "He is our witness." And so here basically what Samuel is saying is, "I've treated you well all throughout your life." And in reality, what Samuel is doing in this text, he's stepping down. He's resigning as their leader. "You've appointed a king over yourself. I am no longer going to be your leader." And then in verses 6 through 11 of chapter 12, he reminds the people of their relationship with Yahweh throughout their history. And it was most of the time rebellious against God. And the point is made is when you rebelled against God, he sent people to punish you. And he describes some of the kings that we read about in the Judges. And he said, and when you repented, he appointed deliverers. And he mentions by name some of the judges that actually delivered the children of Israel. And then he tells them, but now you have demanded a king. And you'll notice in verses 12 and 13, he says, here is the king whom you have chosen and whom you have desired. And take note, the Lord has set a king over you. If you fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and do not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then both you and the king whom reigns over you will continue following the Lord your God. So the point is made there. And in verse number 12, when you saw Nahash, king of the Amorites, came against you, you said to me, no, but a king shall reign over us when the Lord your God was your king. And then he goes on and says, here is your king. So he's making the point, you rejected God as your king. Now that you have a king, if you will remain faithful to God, he will deliver you. And that's the point. He will continue to be with you. But if you rebel against him, then the hand of Yahweh is going to be against you, as he says in verse number 15. And then he goes further. He says, as a sign of this, and he talks about the season in which they were from the standpoint of harvest. And he makes the point that it is the wheat harvest, but you're going to see thunder. You're going to see a tremendous storm on this particular occasion. And the storm actually takes place. And the people are fearful because of this. And they go to Samuel and they say, please pray for us. We have sinned in demanding a king. I don't know if they're trying to retract that or whatever's going on, but we have sinned in demanding a king. But Samuel assures them once again, if you do well, if you remain faithful to God, you will be okay. God will be with you. Just be faithful to him. But then I want you to note at the conclusion of this, in verses 23 through 25, he goes on and says, moreover, ask for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord in ceasing to pray for you, but I will teach you the good and the right way. Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, you shall be swept away, both you and your king. And so we find Samuel says, no, I'm going to keep praying for you. And thus we have this final admonition. And Saul is now reigning as their king. And so I'm going to stop there where the text is concerned. But as I have done with all of these lessons, I want us to just notice some applications that we can make for ourselves. And each of these, I just want to briefly mention these. We could obviously spend a great deal of time with each of these, but let's just consider. And the first question I would ask is, who do you really want to be your king? Do you want the kings of this world, or do you want God as your king? Remember how James in James chapter 4 and verse 4 said, friendship with the world is enmity with God. Or Jesus in Matthew 6 and 24, no one can serve two masters. For either he will be loyal to one, and he will be faithful to one and not the other. You cannot serve God and mammon is the point that he makes in that particular text. That's a lesson that we learn from this. Do you want God to be your king, or do you want some man to be your king? I think another lesson that we can learn from this is that pride and destruction goes before a fall. As a matter of fact, in Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 18, Solomon said, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. At this point, and we're basically done with this, with the lesson we've talked about. King Saul is humble at the beginning, but it's not going to last. We're told to always be humble, to submit to one another, and humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. 1 Peter 5, verses 5 and 6. Another lesson that we can learn from this is the fact that God can use you no matter who you are. You may recall in 1 Samuel 9, 21, this is where Samuel is speaking to Saul, and he's basically saying, you're one who is chosen. And this is where Saul says, you know, I'm of the tribe of Benjamin, the least of the tribes. My family's the least of those in Benjamin. God can use you. Just because you're not of great importance, God could use you. And I'll go further and say that God needs you. And I would remind you of 1 Corinthians chapter 12, where Paul there describes how we are a body of Christ and how every part is important and every part is needed. Another lesson that we learn associated with this is God knows what is going to happen. God is omniscient, which means the idea of all-knowing, and ultimately God is in control. And I want you to recall, as we mentioned in this text, that when Samuel gives Saul instructions to kind of establish the fact that God is with him, he specifies in great detail what's going to happen on his way home. And it happens exactly that way. And that demonstrates how God knows what is going on. Another lesson that we can learn from this is that God does not expect us to blindly follow after him. He gave Saul proof that God was with him. Now understand, we know that we walk by faith and not by sight. 2 Corinthians 5:7. We have to live our lives trusting God. But understand that it's not a blind faith. We have evidence and we have reasons behind our trust in God. He has demonstrated to us enough that we know that he is there. And so, God has given us evidence and reason to follow after him, the same way that he gave Saul evidence on that occasion, and even though Saul was hesitant. Another lesson that we can learn from this is to never stop praying for others. Recall how Samuel toward the end says, I'll continue to pray for you as long as I live. I'll continue to teach you. I'm not going to stop. Even though my work as your leader is done and he steps down, I'm still going to teach you and still do everything I can. And he even went as far as to say, I would sin if I stopped praying for you. Well, you know, we are told to pray for one another in James chapter 5 and in verse 13. Verse 16, the effective fervent prayer of a righteous man accomplishes much, is the point that is emphasized in that text. We need to be praying for each other. Another lesson that we can learn from this is that leaders step up in times of crisis. And that goes back to chapter 11 of our text, where the events associated with Jabesh-Gilead, Saul finally steps up and he becomes the leader, the king that they needed for this time. And along with that, understand that for leaders to be effective, the people need to stand behind them. And I think of as at least as an example of this, you know, there were some who didn't stand behind Saul in the first place. There were men who were described as they were described as rebels. And incidentally, after the victory at Jabesh-Gilead, the people come to Saul and say, let's take those people that rebelled against you, let's execute them. And Saul said, no, not at this time. God has delivered us. He's still maintaining this attitude of humility. But the bottom line is for a leader to be effective, the people have to stand behind their leaders. And that's true spiritually within the church as well. You are to obey those who rule over you. Hebrews 13:17, and it's in a passage that is very likely dealing with elders from that standpoint. And finally, when it comes to serving God, we need to serve God not only with leftovers, but we need to serve God with our entire being, with our whole heart. You know, when Jesus was asked, what is the greatest commandment? The greatest commandment is, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. You love him with everything that you are. And Samuel told the people, if you will serve God with your whole heart, even though you have a king reigning over you, you will be okay. God will be with you. And there are times during the history of Judah where the king was loyal to God and the people were. But other times, not so much. And of course, we'll see that as the history of Israel and Judah unfolds as we continue this study later on. And thus we begin our introduction to the period known as the United Kingdom. And as with all of Scripture, what we have written there's examples for us. It's written for our learning. But as I conclude this lesson, I conclude by simply asking the question here. Who is your king, and how will you serve your king? So think about that, if you will, and if you would, bow with me at this time. Our dear God and our Heavenly Father, again we come to you. We thank you so much that you have given us your word, which gives us examples of how to faithfully serve you and how to not serve you. Help us, dear God, to be respectful of your will in everything that we do. Help us to let our light shine before others and put our trust in you throughout our lives. We are thankful that you have given us our Lord, and we are thankful for all the examples that we have through which we can learn what it means to be pleasing to you. Guide us through this day, guide us through this week, and through the remainder of this year. And may all that we do bring glory to you in our lives. We pray this through his Son, or through your Son, and amen. And again, and as always, thank you for listening to these lessons. I hope that you have found benefit in the things that have been said. As I mentioned at the beginning, this is the final recording of the year, the pre-recorded lesson where the year is concerned. But Lord willing, next year in 2026, we will continue to pick up this mantle of sharing portions of God's Word with you. So for the time being, thank you for everything. May God continue to be with you as you strive to be with Him and serve Him. So until next time, take care and goodbye.